So, real quick before we start, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got this full Series 3 course with, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. It's honestly super helpful. So check it out at certfuel.com. Anyway, let's get into it.
Yeah, let's do it. It's a really efficient way to study. I mean, especially for what we're covering today.
Right, exactly. So picture this. It's the fall of 2008, right? Lehman Brothers collapses. And we literally watch trillions of dollars in wealth just evaporate. The whole global financial system basically freezes.
Utter chaos.
Complete chaos. But in the middle of all that panic, there was this one specific financial mechanism, like this massive hub of risk management that just absorbed the shock. It didn't lose a single penny. And so today, we're diving into the mechanical bedrock that makes that kind of resilience even possible. We're talking about the architecture of the futures contract.
Yeah, and it really is the absolute core of the modern derivatives market. And, if you are studying for your Series 3 right now, getting this architecture down isn't just a nice to have, it is mandatory. I mean, parts 1 through 7 of the exam test, this exact foundational knowledge.
Which is what? A huge chunk of the test.
It's roughly 71% of your overall score.
Wait, 71%? That's insane.
It is. But if you don't grasp the basic physics of the market that we're talking about today, the advanced hedging strategies later on, the complex math, it's going to feel completely impossible. You have to know how to walk before you run.
Right, which makes total sense. But here's the thing, and I'm talking directly to you listening right now. If you're tackling the Series 3, you're probably a busy professional, and you probably tried reading those dry, totally lifeless textbook definitions a million times.
And you just zone out.
Exactly. I zone out. I have ADHD. So if you just read bullet points at me, my brain's in another dimension in 30 seconds. So we're not doing that today. No dry lectures. We're going to look at the actual institutional reality of these rules, the why behind them.
Right, because context is everything. When you understand why a rule exists, which is usually because someone found a loophole and blew up a market, you don't even have to memorize the rule anymore. You just logically deduce it.
Exactly. So to keep this real, we're going to track a few specific people. First up, we've got Farmer Frank.
Ah, Farmer Frank.
But, Frank isn't just some guy in overalls with a single tractor. Frank is the highly neurotic CEO of Frank's Farms, which is this massive agribusiness overseeing like 50,000 acres of wheat across the Midwest.
Right. He's dealing with multi-million dollar price risk.
Exactly. He is terrified of risk. If the price of wheat crashes right before his harvest, his whole corporation goes under. He just wants to lock in a price and sleep at night.
So on the exam, Frank is your classic short hedger. He has the physical stuff, the wheat, and he needs protection against the price dropping.
Spot on. Now, on the other side, we have Baker Betty. Betty is this insanely ambitious founder of Betty's Breads. It's a multinational commercial bakery empire. Her profit margins are razor thin.
Which means input costs are everything to her.
Everything. Her biggest nightmare is a sudden spike in global wheat prices. If wheat skyrockets, her flour costs explode, and her quarterly earnings are totally destroyed.
Making Betty our classic long hedger. She needs the physical commodity in the future, and she's trying to protect herself against a price increase.
Right. And finally, we have Shady Sam.
Shady Sam, always a problem.
Always. Sam doesn't grow wheat. He doesn't bake bread.
Yeah.
Sam runs a highly leveraged proprietary trading desk. He's an institutional speculator who thrives on volatility, and he has this horrible reputation for just ghosting people when his bets blow up. So keep Frank, Betty, and Sam in your head because they are going to physically act out all these exam concepts for us.
I love it. And to really appreciate how a futures contract works, we actually have to look backward first. We need to talk about the system that was so broken that they had to invent futures to fix it.
The origin story.
Yes, the forward contract, the whole architecture of modern clearing is a direct response to how bad forward contracts were.
Okay, let's set the scene. Think about the over-the-counter market, the OTC market. Imagine Farmer Frank and Shady Sam meeting up in this dimly lit diner. There's no exchange, no regulators hovering around. It's just a private handshake deal. Frank has this massive harvest coming. He wants to lock in a price. Sam agrees to take the other side of the bet. They write up a forward contract on a napkin.
And this right here is the defining trait of a forward contract. It is entirely 100% customized. Because it's a private negotiation, Frank and Sam can tailor every single detail.
Right. So Frank can be like, I need to deliver exactly 43,215 bushels.
And Sam says, sure. And Frank says, and I need to drop it off over 3 days, starting on a Tuesday, specifically at your private grain silo behind a strip mall in Omaha.
And Sam agrees to that, too. They can dictate the exact moisture of the wheat, the hour of delivery, everything. It's a totally bespoke legal agreement.
Right.
But wait, let me push back on this for a second.
Go for it.
Because in the real world, customization is like a premium thing, right? People pay millions for bespoke software or tailored legal structures. People love tailored suits. If Frank gets exactly what his farm needs and Sam gets exactly what his trading desk wants, why is this level of customization considered a fatal flaw?
That is the perfect question, and the answer comes down to one word, liquidity. In financial markets, the word bespoke is basically a polite way of saying totally illiquid. Think about it. Let's say 3 months go by, macro conditions change. Shady Sam suddenly needs to get rid of this risk, so he tries to sell his side of the contract to someone else in the market. But who else wants to take delivery of exactly 43,215 bushels of wheat with that specific moisture content at a private silo behind a strip mall in Omaha on a random Tuesday?
Literally nobody.
Nobody. The contract is so uniquely molded to fit Frank and Sam that it is completely useless to the rest of the world.
Right. It's like trying to sell a custom-tailored suit that was made for a guy with one arm shorter than the other. It only fits that one guy.
Exactly. And because they're so customized, you almost never have a secondary market for forwards. You are stuck with it until delivery day. But honestly, as bad as that illiquidity is, it's not even the most catastrophic flaw.
No. What's worse?
The environment it was created in. The private diner.
Mm.
The OTC market. Because there is no public transparency and, more importantly, no central guarantor.
Oh, right. Counterparty risk.
Yes. In a forward contract, Farmer Frank is relying completely on Shady Sam's creditworthiness and ethical integrity.
And we know Sam has none.
Exactly. Let's say Sam agreed to buy Frank's wheat at $8 a bushel. A few months pass, and there's a massive, unexpected global bumper crop. The market is drowning in wheat. The current spot price crashes from $8 down to $3 a bushel.
Okay, so Frank is ecstatic. He locked in $8 when the market is only paying $3. But Shady Sam is looking at a disaster. He has to pay $8 for something that is only worth $3. Across 43,000 bushels, that's a firm-ending loss for his trading desk.
And because this is an OTC forward contract, there is no clearinghouse holding collateral. What do you think a highly leveraged, shady prop desk does when they face a catastrophic loss and there's no central enforcer?
They just walk away. They ghost him.
They default. They declare bankruptcy or tie Frank up in court for 10 years. Delivery day comes and Sam is nowhere to be found. Frank is left holding a mountain of wheat in a crashed market and his farm goes bankrupt. Not because he grew bad wheat, but because his counterparty vanished.
That is insane. Just totally epistemic counterparty risk.
And you can't run a global modern commodities market if every trade carries the risk of total default. So
right.
To solve the liquidity problem and the counterparty risk problem, the market invented the futures contract.
Okay, so here's the pivot. How does the futures contract fix this mess?
It starts by completely outlawing customization. A futures contract is ruthlessly standardized. The exchange steps in and dictates everything. The Chicago Board of Trade says to Frank and Sam, no, you don't get to choose the size. One standard wheat contract is exactly 5,000 bushels.
Not 43,000.
Exactly 5,000.
Mm-hmm.
And they mandate the exact delivery months. They mandate the minimum quality of the wheat. They even dictate the specific certified warehouses where you have to drop it off. Every single December wheat contract is mechanically identical to every other December wheat contract.
Okay, so if you're listening right now, pause what you're doing. I have a direct question for you. If the exchange is standardizing the size, the delivery month, the quality, and the location, what is literally the only variable left for Farmer Frank and Baker Betty to negotiate on the exchange floor?
Think about it.
The exchange locked down the who, what, when, and where. So what's left?
The price.
The price. That's the only thing they decide. Everything else is a carbon copy.
And because everything else is a carbon copy, these contracts are fungible. They are perfectly interchangeable.
I like to call this the factory versus handshake rule for the exam. You have to visualize a futures contract as this factory-made, mass-produced widget. It rolls off an assembly line. They all look exactly the same, so they are incredibly easy to swap and trade. That's a future. A forward is a private handshake. It's unique. You can't trade a personal handshake to someone else. You're just stuck with it.
That is a great mental model. And we really need to flag an exam trap right here. The examiners are going to try to use standard English against you.
Oh, yeah. They love doing this. Listen closely to how the language works on the test.
In real life, words like flexible, customized, tailored, those are positive words, right? We love flexible schedules. So on a multiple choice question, they'll ask you to identify the primary traits of a futures contract. And one of the wrong answers will say something like, features flexible delivery terms tailored to the buyer's needs.
It sounds so customer friendly, but it's a trap.
It is a lethal trap. If you see the words customize, flexible, bespoke, or tailored attached to a futures contract, eliminate it immediately. Those words belong exclusively to forwards. Futures are rigid. Do not let the positive vibe of the word flexible trick you.
Got it. Okay, so we've solved the liquidity problem with standardization, but let me push back again.
Okay.
Standardization just makes the contracts identical. It doesn't change human nature, right? Shady Sam is still Shady Sam. Even if he's trading a perfectly standard 5,000 bushel contract, if the market crashes, what actually stops him from ghosting Frank on the public exchange?
That is the trillion-dollar question. Because you're right, standardization alone does not fix default risk. To stop Sam from running away, the market needed a central guarantor, an entity that literally steps into the middle of every single trade and absorbs all the systemic risk.
Enter the true hero of this deep dive. The clearinghouse.
Exactly. And to understand the clearinghouse, we have to talk about the heaviest vocabulary word in this unit, novation. N-O-V-A-T-I-O-N.
Novation.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds so dry and legal, but yeah. It's actually an awesome concept.
It's elegant. It is the legal mechanism where the clearinghouse substitutes itself as the counterparty to both sides of a trade. I like to think of it like a massive power grid transformer. You don't plug your laptop directly into a nuclear power plant. The raw voltage would instantly vaporize it.
Right.
The power goes into a transformer, which absorbs that raw risk, standardizes it, and guarantees a safe flow of electricity to your device.
I have a slightly more ridiculous analogy for this, but it works.
Let's hear it.
Think of the clearinghouse like this aggressively helpful bouncer on a blind date. Frank and Betty sit down at a table. They agree to trade 100 contracts of wheat. The very second they agree on the price, this bouncer walks up, violently chops the table in half, sits directly in the middle, and points at them. He says, Frank, you no longer owe Betty, you owe me. Betty, Frank doesn't owe you, I owe you.
That is exactly what happens mechanically.
Right. The original connection is just severed. So Frank isn't relying on Betty's bakery staying in business, and Betty isn't relying on Frank's crops. They're both looking at the bouncer.
And because that bouncer, the clearinghouse, is backed by billions of dollars in emergency capital, the risk of default practically drops to zero.
Okay, let's drill this for the exam real quick.
Yeah, let's test it.
If the exam asks you, who guarantees the financial performance and integrity of a futures contract? They're going to give you choices like the exchange, the broker, or the clearinghouse.
Don't fall for the distractors.
Exactly. Do you answer the exchange? No. Do you answer the broker? No. The answer is always, always the clearinghouse. Through novation, they assume the liability.
But that leads to the next logical question. If the clearinghouse is stepping into the middle of thousands of trades every day, basically acting as a giant sponge for all this risk, how does it survive? How does it not just blow up and go bankrupt when the market crashes?
Yeah, if the transformer takes too much raw voltage without releasing it, it explodes. So how do they follow the money?
They enforce a very ruthless two-part system, margin and mark-to-market.
Okay, let's talk about margin first. Because margin in futures is completely different than margin in the stock market, right?
Completely different. If you buy stocks on margin, you're getting a loan from your broker to buy more shares. You're borrowing money. In futures, margin is not a loan. It is not a down payment. It is a performance bond.
A good faith deposit.
Exactly. It's a pool of collateral sitting in an account that just proves you have the cash to honor your bet. Both the buyer and the seller have to post this initial margin before they can even trade.
Got it. So they have this pool of cash from everyone, but a static pile of cash won't save you if prices are swinging wildly every day.
Which is why the ultimate risk tool is the mark-to-market process. They settle the gains and losses for every single open position at the end of every single trading day.
This is so important. Contrast this with the OTC forward contract we talked about earlier. In that diner handshake deal, Shady Sam was losing money every single day for 3 months as the wheat price dropped, but he didn't have to actually pay up until delivery day.
Which is why it snowballed into a total catastrophe. The risk just compounded in the dark.
Exactly. It was a ticking time bomb.
Yeah.
But mark-to-market diffuses the bomb every 24 hours. Let's do a timeline. It's Monday morning. Shady Sam goes long on a highly leveraged crude oil contract. He puts up his $5,000 initial margin. Monday afternoon, some bad news drops, oil tanks. By the market close, Sam's position has lost $1,500. What does the clearinghouse do?
They do not wait until the end of the month. That very night, during the overnight clearing cycle, the clearinghouse legally reaches into Sam's margin account, takes that $1,500 in cash, and wires it directly to the trader holding the short position who won that money.
Wow. So Sam wakes up on Tuesday, checks his account, and he's only got $3,500 left.
He paid his debt in real time.
Okay, so what if Tuesday's even worse? Oil drops again, he loses another $2,000. Tuesday night, they take another $2,000. He's down to $1,500.
At this point, Sam has breached his maintenance margin level. That's the absolute minimum floor the clearinghouse allows. So what happens Wednesday morning?
He gets a margin call.
A huge margin call. And he has to wire fresh funds immediately to restore that account all the way back up to the original initial margin level.
Not just back to the maintenance line.
No, all the way back up to initial. And if he tries to ignore them, if he tries to ghost the clearinghouse like he did Farmer Frank.
They just close him out, right?
Instantly. The clearinghouse forcibly liquidates his position on the open market. They neutralize his risk before he can lose more money than he has in his account. That daily discipline is how the clearinghouse survives. Losses never, ever snowball.
That is brilliant. Okay,
yeah.
So exam takeaway. If a question describes a contract where gains and losses are settled daily, that is marking to market, and it is exclusively a futures concept. If the risk piles up until the final delivery date, that's an OTC forward.
Perfect. Now, before we leave the clearinghouse stuff, we have to talk about who actually gets to talk to the clearinghouse, because there is a strict hierarchy. The exam tests the difference between clearing members and non-clearing members.
The VIP list. Who gets past the velvet rope?
Clearing members are your massive global investment banks and heavily capitalized clearing firms. They have direct access to the clearinghouse, but because they are the ultimate backstop, the clearinghouse demands astronomical capital from them, hundreds of millions of dollars in reserves.
Okay, so they're inside the fortress. But what about like a smaller regional broker or a boutique trading desk? They don't have $500 million lying around to pledge to the exchange.
Right. So they are classified as non-clearing members. And because they don't have that capital, they are strictly forbidden from settling trades directly with the clearinghouse.
So how do their clients even trade? If I use a boutique broker, how does my trade get guaranteed?
A non-clearing member has to route or clear all their trades through an affiliated VIP clearing member. The clearing member acts as a bridge. They hold the non-clearing member's accounts on their own books.
So the VIP is vouching for them.
Exactly. If the small broker goes bankrupt, the VIP clearing member is still on the hook to the clearinghouse for all those trades.
Okay, let's frame the exam trap here. If you're reading a multiple choice question, and one option says that a non-clearing member settles its accounts directly with the clearinghouse, what do you do?
You cross it out immediately. Non-clearing members never have a direct line to the clearinghouse. It always flows through a clearing member.
Got it. Okay, so we've built the foundation. The contracts are standardized. The clearinghouse guarantees them via novation. And daily mark-to-market keeps the risk contained. Frank and Betty are locked in. But what if things change? Let's say it's October. Betty's Breads is holding this massive long position. She is legally contracted to take physical delivery of 500,000 bushels of wheat in December to run her factories.
Right, a totally normal commercial hedge.
But then, out of nowhere, the keto diet goes hyper mainstream overnight. Nobody is eating carbs. Betty is a ruthless CEO. She sees the writing on the wall, and she pivots the entire corporation. She converts all her factories to make almond flour and cauliflower crust bread.
Drastic, but it happens.
It totally happens. But now she has a massive problem. She's got these clearinghouse contracts demanding she accept 500,000 bushels of traditional wheat in December. She doesn't have the machines for it anymore, and she definitely doesn't want it dumped in her parking lot. How does she pull off the great escape? Is she legally doomed?
She is not doomed at all. In fact, this brings us to the offset provision. And statistically, you should know this for the real world. Well over 95% of all futures contracts are offset before delivery ever happens. Most people use this market for price discovery, not physical delivery.
Okay, so if 95% of people aren't taking delivery, what is the exact mechanic of offsetting? Think about it logically. If Betty is locked in with the clearinghouse and the delivery terms are unchangeable, the only way out is to do the exact opposite trade, right?
You nailed it. Offsetting simply means liquidating an open position by executing an equal and opposite transaction. You become the mirror image of yourself.
Let's trace it on the ledger. Betty originally opened her position by buying December wheat. She is long. So to get out, she has to enter the market and sell an identical amount of December wheat.
Right. And remember Novation, the clearinghouse, is sitting in the middle. So they look at Betty's account and they see two entries. Entry one, Betty is obligated to buy 500,000 bushels from us. Entry two, Betty is obligated to sell 500,000 bushels to us.
And they just cancel each other out.
Exactly. They net perfectly to zero. The physical delivery requirement vanishes, and Betty just pays or receives whatever the cash difference was between her entry and exit prices.
No physical wheat ever moves. She's free. Now, what about the short side? If Farmer Frank is short, meaning he sold contracts initially, how does he offset if, say, a drought destroys his crops and he has no wheat to deliver?
Same exact mirror logic. He was short, so he offsets by buying identical contracts. The clearinghouse sees his obligation to deliver netted against his new right to receive, and the physical requirement is extinguished.
Okay, pattern interrupt. Wake up. If you're on the treadmill, stop and listen to me right now. Break the fourth wall with me. This next detail is the number one trap on this section of the test.
It really is.
The mechanics of offsetting seem way too simple. You buy, then you sell. Easy. Which is exactly why the exam writers weaponize it. They are going to test your attention to detail on what constitutes a true offset.
You have to follow the same month requirement. To offset, your liquidating trade must be for the exact same commodity, the exact same quantity, on the exact same exchange, and in the exact same delivery month.
Let's run a drill on this. Listen carefully to this scenario. Shady Sam is short 1,000 contracts of December crude oil. Geopolitical tensions spike, oil surges, and Sam is facing a massive margin call. He panics. He logs into his terminal, and in a rush to close out his risk, he BUYS 1,000 contracts of merge crude oil. Direct question to you listening. Think about it. Short December buys March. Did Sam successfully offset? Give it a beat.
The answer is unequivocally no.
But why? He did an equal and opposite trade. He was short 1,000. He bought 1,000. Why didn't the clearinghouse cancel it?
Because they're different standardized products.
Yeah.
A December contract is a completely different factory widget than a March contract. You cannot net a December obligation against a March right. By trading a different month, Sam didn't close anything. He actually just created a spread.
The spread, yeah.
Yes, a spread is when you hold simultaneous open positions in different delivery months. The clearinghouse looks at his account and says, cool, you still have to deliver oil in December, and now you've also promised to take delivery in March. He doubled his obligations.
I love comparing this to a gym membership. Imagine you have a gym membership that runs through December, but in October, you decide you want to cancel. So to get out of your December liability, you go and buy a brand new gym membership at a completely different gym that starts in March.
Which is completely unhelpful.
Right. You didn't cancel anything. You just have two gym memberships now, and you're still getting billed in December.
Yeah.
In futures, December only cancels December. March only cancels March. If the month doesn't match perfectly, you're in a spread, not an offset.
And this seamlessly connects back to our first section. You can only offset because of standardization. Since every December contract is identical, they can cleanly net to zero. You could never do that with an OTC forward because every forward is a unique, unmatchable snowflake.
Oh, that makes so much sense. Standardization creates fungibility. Fungibility creates offsetting. And offsetting creates all this massive liquidity. But we still have to talk about the rare delivery.
The 5%.
Right. We know 95% of people offset. But what if Farmer Frank actually wants to roll his trucks up and deliver the physical wheat? Because honestly, if physical delivery didn't exist, a futures contract would just be a floating casino bet, completely disconnected from reality.
Exactly. Physical delivery is the anchor that forces the futures price and the cash price to eventually converge.
So if Frank is rolling a mile-long train of grain cars up to a Chicago delivery facility, we need strict rules for what is inside those cars. If I'm the institutional buyer, I expect high-quality industrial-grade wheat. I'm not paying millions for moldy garbage.
Which brings us to the basis grade, also referred to on the exam as the par grade or the contract grade.
Basis grade, par grade, contract grade, all the same thing.
Yep. The basis grade is the highly specific benchmark quality standard of the commodity that is deliverable at the exact negotiated price with zero price adjustments. When you see a price ticking on a screen for December wheat, that price is explicitly tied to the basis grade.
It's a gold standard for that contract. But wait, let's reason this out. If the basis grade is the ideal standard, why doesn't the exchange just say only the basis grade is allowed? Why allow any variations or substitutes? Keep it pure.
Well, agricultural yields are dictated by the weather. Supply is finite. If the exchange only allowed one hyper-specific, perfect grade of wheat, the physical supply of eligible wheat would be tiny.
And a tiny supply is dangerous.
Extremely dangerous. It creates the perfect setup for a market manipulation tactic called a corner or a squeeze. Think about Shady Sam. He realizes the global supply of pure basis grade wheat is really low this year because of a drought. So he aggressively buys up all the physical basis grade wheat in the cash market while simultaneously holding a massive long position in the futures market.
Oh man, I see where this is going.
As expiration approaches, all the short sellers, the farmers who have to deliver, suddenly realize they can't acquire the basis grade wheat. Sam owns all of it.
They are trapped. They have a legal obligation to deliver, and Sam has monopolized the only legal asset.
Yes. He cornered the market. This famously happened with the Hunt brothers in the silver market. The shorts are forced to go to Sam and pay him whatever extortionate price he demands just to buy the physical wheat or offset their positions to avoid defaulting.
So how does the exchange structurally defend against that?
By expanding the pool of deliverable supply, they allow approved substitutes. They say, the basis grade is the benchmark, but to prevent a squeeze, you can also deliver slightly superior or slightly inferior grades as long as they meet our secondary criteria.
Okay, but that defuses the squeeze because the shorts can just deliver the substitutes. But wait, if I'm the buyer and I contracted for the perfect basis grade and you deliver an inferior substitute, I'm losing money. How is that fair?
The exchange balances it with a mandatory system of premiums and discounts. If a seller delivers an improved substitute that is actually higher quality than the basis grade, they receive a premium. The buyer pays a little more because they're getting a better product.
Makes sense. Better product, higher payout.
And if the seller delivers an approved substitute that is slightly lower quality, the trade settles at a discount. The seller gets less money, which compensates the buyer for receiving a slightly inferior asset.
Okay, let's test the listener's logic right here. Direct question. We know there's a basis grade, and we know there are premium and discount substitutes. But on delivery day, who actually holds the power? Who chooses which approved grade arrives? Is it the long, the buyer receiving it? Or is it the short, the seller delivering it?
Think about the logistics. Who holds the power?
Right. It has to be the short.
The short chooses.
Here is the memory trick for this. The short is the entity physically in control of the supply chain. The short is Farmer Frank backing his trucks up to the silo. You cannot force a farmer to magically spawn premium wheat out of thin air if his farm only grew standard discount grade wheat that season. The guy physically holding the goods makes the choice. The short chooses.
It is a logistical necessity. The buyer, the long, just has to accept whichever approved grade the short delivers, and the financials are adjusted via the premium or discount.
Awesome. Now, before we hit our recap, we have to flag one massive terminology trap.
The double meaning trap.
Yes. The English language is a mess, and the exam writers exploit it. It's all about the word basis.
Right. So we just spent a ton of time talking about the basis grade. In this context, basis grade is a physical qualitative standard. Moisture, weight, physical specs of the wheat.
Physical stuff you can touch.
But when you get into the hedging and options chapters later on, you're going to see a mathematical formula that is just called basis. And in hedging, the basis is defined mathematically as the local cash price minus the futures price.
Cash minus futures. It's just a math equation to find local price differences.
Exactly. It is driven by transportation costs and local supply. It has absolutely zero to do with the physical quality of a delivery.
So basis grade is physical quality. Hedging basis is a math equation.
They are totally separate concepts that happen to share a root word. When you see basis on the test, pause. Ask yourself, are they asking about physical delivery quality or are they asking me to calculate the math between cash and futures? Do not blur them together.
Love it. All right. We have covered a massive amount of institutional architecture today. From the flawed OTC forwards to standardized futures, the clearinghouse bouncer, and the physical delivery rules. Let's lock this into short-term memory. We're doing a rapid-fire recap of the five deadliest traps we discussed today. Let's go. Trap number one.
Trap one. Customized versus standardized. If a question uses words like customized, flexible, bespoke, or tailored, it's a forward contract. Futures are rigidly standardized factory products.
Trap number two, the guarantor. Who guarantees the trade? It is always the clearinghouse via novation. It is never the broker, never the exchange.
Trap three, the escape mechanism. To offset, you must execute the opposite trade in the exact same delivery month. If the month is different, you didn't offset, you just created a spread.
Trap four, delivery. If physical delivery happens, the short chooses the grade. Better grade gets a premium, lower grade gets a discount. The guy with the truck makes the call.
And trap five, the vocabulary. Basis grade is a physical quality standard. Hedging basis is the mathematical difference between cash and futures. Do not mix them up.
Master those five mechanics, and you are going to crush this section in the test. But real quick, before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final, slightly provocative thought to chew on as you keep studying.
Lay it on us.
So we spent all this time today talking about Farmer Frank's physical wheat and how the basis grade stops a short squeeze by allowing physical substitutes, tangible stuff you can put on a train.
Right.
But think about modern finance. The vast majority of futures trading isn't in wheat or gold anymore. It's financial. So how do these exact same delivery mechanics apply when the commodity you are trading has no physical form whatsoever? What is the basis grade when you're trading futures on an interest rate or the S&P 500 or weather derivatives based on cooling degree days?
It's a crazy concept. You have to mathematically adapt physical rules for a digital world.
It's exactly. It's brilliant financial engineering. As you move deeper into your materials, keep an eye on how these tangible 19th century agricultural rules stretch and adapt to govern the invisible digital world of modern finance. Keep analyzing those mechanics, trust your process, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.